As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
That was former General and President of the United States, Dwight David Eisenhower. And what he was warning us about in his farewell speech as president, a thing that was called the military-industrial complex. General Eisenhower was one of the main planners of the Normandy invasion that brought World War II to a close on the Western Front. General Eisenhower knew probably better than anyone else ever to occupy the Oval Office, the inner workings of the United States military machine. As he left office, he was fearful that we had now developed in this country a permanent establishment which would see to it that an inordinate amount of United States resources flowed into this military-industrial complex. We have to ask questions about a military-industrial complex in the wake of the war with Iraq, a war that estimates are going to cost us probably $100 billion. We've already set aside $80 billion to finance this war. In the wake of it, there's been numerous news stories about San Francisco-based Bechtel Corporation, a well-connected corporation to be sure, with people like George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger, former cabinet members of the Reagan administration and Bush administration, on the board at Bechtel. Bechtel's been awarded contracts that could be worth up to several billion dollars in the rebuilding of Iraq. Those are dollars that you and I are going to kick in to help support the Bechtel Corporation, apparently. After all, defense dollars that go to defense contractors ultimately come from you and I, the taxpayer. I think it's fair to say that there are links between U.S. militarism, foreign policy, and corporate greed at home and abroad. A book addressing those very issues, again, is the book Addicted to War, subtitled Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism. It's published by fervent peace activist Frank Durrell, who's joining us in the program to talk about the book. Well, I guess the first question I'd have for you, Frank, is how'd you get interested in publishing this book, Addicted to War?
I guess it goes back to all the way back 20 years ago when I discovered KPFK, Pacifica Radio here in Los Angeles, listener-sponsored. And I just discovered it on the radio by chance, and I started hearing people like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and Ramsey Clark, people talking about U.S. foreign policy, about things that I wasn't aware of. And that was my beginning. Got involved. I started reading the books, these people, and hearing their talks, going to see them in person, many of them, many ex-CIA people, and getting learning about what I call the true nature of U.S. foreign policy, or the big lie we're living. 3 years ago, I put together my video, What I've Learned About U.S. Foreign Policy, which is a way of educating people to these truths.
You have a website, by the way. People can actually take a look at that video. And
yes, our website is addictedtowar.com. It's the title of our book, addictedtowar.com. And the first thing they'll see there is the book, Addicted to War. And then if they click on video, they can go and see what the video is all about.
Yeah.
Those are the two main things that I have been putting out there now. The book since for a year now. And the video actually for 3 years. Quite a lot since after 9/11. The interest in my video went up, and they're both two educational tools, you know, that are being used all over the country in schools, colleges, and high schools to educate people about what I call the true nature of U.S. foreign policy. The story with the book is I found it. It was originally written by the author's Joel Andreas. The subtitle is, the title is "Addicted to War: Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism," and it's an illustrated expose by Joel Andreas. It's really a high-class comic book format.
And Joel Andreas was a PhD candidate at UCLA?
He is. He is right now. He's almost finished. He's just about finished. He's been accepted at Johns Hopkins in the fall. He's a sociologist, and right now he's finishing his dissertation. He's writing a 500-page book on the Chinese Revolution. And I've interfered with this process, and he's behind because I brought his book back, and we've now done two updates, it's kind of put him behind. So he's really scrambling to finish so he can go, you know, meet his obligations with that.
Well, your aim appears to be, I think, in this book, to aim at younger readers, perhaps people in high school or college that don't know a lot of this. Well, or really for anyone, but yeah. I think the comic book type format does lend itself toward a lot of younger readers.
Yeah, it is for anyone, but of course, younger people like it. It's attractive to them, and just looking at the cover attracts people. It's, you know, it's colorful, the title and everything, Joel has done such a brilliant job with the book of making it readable, the history of U.S. militarism from the beginning of this country up all the way through 9/11.
Yeah.
And it's all footnoted and documented.
You have 145 footnotes, numerous quotes throughout the book, which are documented as to who said them in history.
Right, and that's a very important item there, the quotes that are in there. If you went to and read some of them, they're really incredible, some of them, and, from people in the government, from people in the military and big business. And anyway, so I found Joel's book. It was out of print. It was dead in the water, and nothing was happening with it. And I found Joel living near me here, and a couple years ago, and I said to him, Joel, this book needs to be back out there. Do you mind if I try? Never published a book in my life before. And Joel said, let's go ahead. And so I raised the money. Quite a bit of the money I raised came from people who had bought my video. And I got all these great endorsements for the book, and Joel redid it after 9/11. Then he wrote the new chapter called The War on Terrorism, updated the whole book. And in April, we had 20,000 printed. A year later now, it's 100,000 printed here in this country. And it's reached number 9 on the LA Times, Los Angeles Times bestseller list. It's also 60,000 or more now sold in Japan and Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Korean. It's coming in Spanish, and it's also coming in lots of other languages.
Well, you certainly take it upon yourself to do something about that. We talked at last week's show to Greg Palast about a lot of things that are somewhat depressing, but he said at the back of his book to go ahead and get involved, and that's certainly what you've done.
Yes, exactly. When I started learning these things, my mind was always thinking, how can I get others to see this? My basic theory is, how can it change this system of war? The system that really is, once again, the big lie, because people don't really know it. Because they've been told something else. They've been told we are the good guys fighting against evil everywhere, and nothing we would do would be wrong. Or at, you know, at the worst, we've made mistakes. But my thinking is always, well, if definitely they aren't mistakes, they're not aberrations. This is the policies of this country. The people that run this country, the people that own the country, have been to have wars against other people and kill them.
Yeah.
And by the millions, and take their resources and their land and use them for people as for cheap labor. And it's not right. And if Americans knew, they wouldn't stand for it. So my thinking has always been trying to help to wake more Americans up to see this. And so the book and my video both are, I think, excellent ways of doing that. And that's what I'm engaged in doing.
Well, it's well documented, and there certainly is a wealth of information for people interested in this. You do have a section in the book for various activist groups out there. I might want to mention some other reading that I just pulled off my shelf at home. Actually, three books I think that would be nice companions to yours on someone's bookshelf if they're interested in this, and I think people should be. The War Business by George Thayer, The International Trade in Armaments from 1969. Of course, it's quite outdated by now, but tells a lot of the history. Anthony Sampson's book, The Arms Bazaar, and a more recent effort, Take the Rich Off Welfare, Mark Zeppenzauer and Arthur Naiman, which has a really interesting chapter in the beginning about military waste and fraud. And I think that the amount of money that we do spend on the military in this country, I was surprised in reading the numbers that seem pretty well documented in your book, that it's actually a higher figure than you'd be led to believe just by looking at the Pentagon portion of the federal budget.
Spending our children's future on controlling the world here and hurting other people, when we could spend that money on human needs, on health care, on our schools, on senior citizens, on the environment, on just making this planet, for not just Americans, but for everybody, a better place to live. Instead, they're using it to have a war system that is negative, that is violent, that is deadly in more ways than one. It's just crazy. It's insane.
As your book points out, if you took all of the amount of money spent, I think since World War II, was it, the figure $15 trillion spent on military expenditures by the United States, that's basically equal to the United States infrastructure.
Yes, isn't that something?
It certainly is. I think we don't realize that at this point in time, I believe the United States military budget is greater than that of the next 16 nations combined.
I think it's even more than that now.
Well, I guess if you add the $80 billion we just spent on Iraq.
What a sad thing that was. I mean, we went into this country that we've already devastated from the Persian Gulf War and the sanctions for 12 years. And the fact that most Americans don't know, we've never stopped bombing Iraq. Almost every week they were bombed for 12 years. The UNICEF and the World Health Organization, the Red Cross, are the ones stating that, estimating 5,000 children under the age of 5 have been dying in Iraq all these 12 years due to the sanctions the UN has placed on Iraq, but the UN is being run by the United States and England. And it's a genocide. And they hear it twisted around. They blame it on Saddam Hussein. And I always tell people, even if Saddam Hussein is guilty of everything that we say, and he is, of course, guilty of some of the things, why does it make it right for our country to do this to the people there? And I just don't understand that logic. And then I go on to tell people, and it's in the book, of course, that Saddam Hussein was put in power by the CIA. And of course, the thing before he went into Kuwait 12 years ago, he met with our ambassador. It's right in the book, April Glaspie. So, if the United States didn't want him to attack Kuwait, I think all we would have had to do is tell him, seeing as how he was our man. He worked with us, and we had empowered him and armed him to fight Iran for 8 years, where 1 million people were killed. And I might add, also during the time we were arming Iraq to fight Iran, we were also arming Iran, which is what this country does. It's the biggest business. The war is the biggest business.
Your title is addicted to war, but it's addicted to arms sales as well.
Yes, and it's a sad state of a situation. But the same people that are doing the wars, that are running this country and own the country, that have the most money, they do. This is a key point. They do own the mainstream media. And so they spin it differently. Their propaganda, their misinformation is such state-of-the-art, it's so sophisticated, they're able to get people to believe something else. I can say our book is being used by a lot of professors around the country and high school teachers and some middle school teachers as a history textbook, which people find amazing because it is a comic book, but when you really open it up and look at it, you realize it is. It's sort of, in a way, a junior version of Howard Zinn's The People's History.
I've not read that book, but I've heard good things about it. Now, you have in the closing in the book to do something about it, once you've made the case for how we're in sort of a bit of a fix right now and perhaps need to go in a different direction. Are there any groups in here you particularly would strongly endorse for our listeners?
We did add at the end, do something about it, and we've listed 17 national anti-war organizations for people to check out, get involved with. The first one I would mention is Veterans for Peace, that's who I work with. And they're right on the front cover, endorsed by Veterans for Peace. And this is a group of veterans all over the country, in fact, all over the world, who are working toward ending war. And all these organizations we've listed here are doing the same. America's Friends Service Committee and Fellowship of Reconciliation, Global Exchange, International Access Center, not in her name, True Majority, which is Ben Cohn, who of Ben and Jerry's.
Uh-huh.
They took 1,000 books. Office of the Americas is here in Los Angeles. Peace Action is a great group. School of the Americas Watch is focusing on closing the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Teaching for Change is a group of progressive teachers all over the country. Then we have War Resisters League. Voices in the Wilderness is a group led by Kathy Kelly, who has been focusing on exposing what we've been doing to Iraq with the sanctions all these years. And the last one here in the alphabetic order is Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And all these groups are working to end war, to end the war system, to expose these lies. And I can tell you, most all these groups are selling our book from their own websites.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting to have so many people who believe in this book as such a great vehicle to teach people.
Well, I think a lot of people who are informed about a lot of situations would certainly find this to be interesting and accurate reading. I noticed in the back of the book, you quote a Colonel James Burkholder, U.S. Army retired, saying, as a veteran of 3 wars, World War II through Vietnam, with 33 years of Army service, I find this book to be the most truthful recitation of our government's policies available anywhere.
Isn't that something?
That's quite a good endorsement.
I'm going to tell you, I met him. That really wasn't even an endorsement I sought out. That was a letter he sent me after he read the book. And I kept it. And then when it came time to update our book, I called him up and I asked him. We talked, and he loves this book. He also loves my video. And I asked him, can we use that statement on the back cover of the book? And he goes, yes, please do. And I've since met him. I met him in Arizona. He lives in Tucson.
Uh-huh.
And he's 80 years old. He's totally together guy. And he's lived through it. He was telling me all these stories. He lived through many of this stuff in the book here. You know, the things that have happened. He was part of it as his position in the Army all those years. And he's somebody who came to see the light. And it's good to have endorsements like that. I'm so proud of all these people we have endorsing our book. Ramsey Clark, you know, the former Attorney General of the United States, who I just consider the number one peace activist in America myself. And he endorses our book. And, of course, we have the acting president of the United States, Martin Sheen, Susan Sarandon, Ed Asner, and Chris Christopherson, Howard Zinn, who I had mentioned, Ron Kovic, Oliver Stone made the movie Born on the 4th of July,
mm-hmm.
and so many others on the inside cover here that endorsed the book. Reverend James Lawson taught nonviolence with Martin Luther King,
yeah.
and, of course, Father Roy Bourgeois, who is the Maryknoll priest who's been fighting to close the School of Americas for all these years. And I might point out, quite a few of these people are veterans.
I would imagine that a lot of veterans would feel this way, having seen firsthand that, you know, a lot of money that we spend isn't necessarily making anyone safer or freer.
I mean, all these people are heroes of mine. And Helen Kellicott is one of the first people I ever heard speaking about, not just U.S. militarism, but speaking about the state of the conditions on this earth, about nuclear war, about the environment, about the corporations. Helen Kellicott is a pediatrician from Australia who's lived, spent a lot of years living here. And she is about as strong as a speaker as you'll ever hear. And her statement reads here in the book, "This book analyzes why men are addicted to fighting and killing, an addiction that could, in this nuclear age, destroy all of life on Earth, creating the final epidemic of the human race." Pretty strong statement there, but, you know, it's...
Yeah, I like the title of one of her books, Missile Envy.
Right, right. Helen is... I mean, she's an icon. She is just an absolute legend of people in the peace movement.
Frank Durrell, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about your book, Addicted to War. If people want to check that out, they should go to your website, addictedtowar.com.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a fair question to ask. Might we be coming addicted to war? News item from the Arms Sales Monitoring Project at the Federation of American Scientists. According to their report in August of last year on conventional arms transferred to developing nations, 1994 to 2001, the U.S. had the largest share of both new contracts and deliveries to the world for all eight of those years. In the calendar year 2001, U.S. arms manufacturers made new agreements worth $12.1 billion and delivered $9.7 billion worth of arms, capturing 45% of both markets. The U.S.'s closest competitor, Russia, came in a distant second. This story is not going away over in Iraq regarding the rebuilding of the country and contracts being awarded for same. We will continue to follow it. But I think we should end this segment, again returning to the words of Dwight David Eisenhower, a general who knew what he was talking about when he addressed issues regarding the military. Let me quote from Dwight Eisenhower. "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machine of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together." Speaking in 1961 in the wake of World War II, Eisenhower said, "The conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, and every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. For an updated viewpoint of this and other military-industrial complex-related issues, I would recommend that you get a copy of Joel Andreas's Addicted to War, Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism. We'd like to thank Mr. Frank Dorrell for appearing on this segment of the program. We must take a short break. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM.